Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Cubberley Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Colleen Wilcox. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Ayan Hirsi Ali. Ayan is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of Nomad, From Islam to America, A Personal Journey Through the Clash of Civilizations. Born in Somalia, Ayan lived in Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Kenya, before seeking political asylum in the Netherlands. She served in the Dutch Parliament for 3 years, where she focused on furthering the integration of non-Western immigrants and defending the rights of women in Dutch Muslim society. Her life changed drastically in 2004 when she collaborated with director Theo van Gogh on a film about the oppression of women in conservative Islamic societies. After the film aired, director van Gogh was assassinated, and Ayan was forced into hiding after receiving numerous death threats. Despite her life being threatened, Ayan continued her work as an advocate for social and political issues surrounding women's rights, tolerance, and multiculturalism. In 2007, she established the AHA Foundation to help protect and defend the rights of women in the West against militant Islam, the best-selling author of A Caged Virgin and Infidel. Ayan has been awarded the Norway Human Rights Bellwether of the Year Award, the Denmark Freedom Prize, Sweden's Democracy Prize, and the Moral Courage Award, which recognized her continued commitment to conflict resolution, ethics, and, of course, world citizenship. Noted journalist Christopher Hitchens has said, "For me, the three most beautiful words in the emerging language of secular resistance to tyranny are Ayan Hirsi Ali." Now, our moderator for this evening is Suzanne Perry, author of The Fortune Catcher. Suzanne was raised in an Orthodox Muslim family, both in Iran and in America, where she was born. She is the author, as I said, of The Fortune Catcher, a novel about religious fundamentalism and the Iranian Revolution. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Suzanne Perry and, of course, Ayan Hirsi Ali.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome, Ayan. Firstly, I'd like to tell you and the audience that if you want to ask any questions or have me ask questions of Ayan, please fill out your cards and send them up as soon as possible. I will try to flip through them and find questions that are appropriate and not the same as my own. And Ayan, if I'm not looking at you when you're answering me, and I'm looking down at the questions, I'm not ignoring you. I'm just... I'd like to ask the audience one thing, and I will let radio know what the answer is. How many of you have read Infidel? Looks like 310 people have read Infidel.
Thank you. That means you all know me and I don't know you.
That's very true. Poor thing. So, since everyone has read the first book, the first memoir that you wrote, I would like to talk, of course, mostly about Nomad, which is, in some sense, a recapitulation, but more of a furtherance of what you were going through in Infidel and what happened to you after Van Gogh was stabbed and you were in Parliament and you had to leave and you had a great security problem and then your Dutch citizenship was reneged but reinstated. And you talk about that in Infidel. But what you do, in Nomad, but what you do talk about in Nomad at first is your family and what's happened to them since you finished Infidel. And this to me was, of course, very interesting and riveting because I believe, and I know you believe, that the family is the microcosm of society. And so we learned very much in Infidel about Muslim society in Somalia and in other countries like Saudi Arabia through your eyes and your family's eyes. You seemed a little softer toward your father this time. And I imagine that's because you do visit him on his deathbed. And you felt regret, you said, for not seeing him more often. However, he wasn't very open to your life, was he? Can you comment a little bit about how you feel now about your relationship with him and also with your mother and your siblings and other members of your family?
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry. Would you like a specific question?
Well, that covers the whole book. It's audiences like you who inspired, I think in a way asked for a follow-up, because the number of questions I got after publishing Infidel were so many that I couldn't answer them in emails or in just one article or just say to one person, you know, okay, I'm going to answer that question. The questions were many, and I brought them down to, okay, what is your relationship right now with your family? There are so many people who are interested in that. And the first part of the book is devoted to reconciling, or at least attempting to reconcile with my father, with my mother, and then trying to use not just my life story as an illustration. I don't really, in Infidel, I don't talk about Muslim families. I just talk about my own experience. My relationship with my father is reignited in June of 2007. 2008. I'm on book tour. I'm on my way to Australia. I'm on my way to Brazil. I'm on my way to JFK Airport. I have to catch a flight. The telephone rings. It's my father. And my father goes on and on about, oh my goodness, it's, you know, good to hear your voice. But then he starts reading passages from the Quran. He has a mission, and that is get me back
before he dies
to become a believer. I know that he's dying. And what I want to ask him about is, Dad, how are you feeling? My cousin told me you're sick. What does that mean? My father at that time is 78. It could mean anything. So for me, it's just all these emotions are going through me. How are you? How long are you going to live? Will I be able to see you? I don't get a word in. He just says, think about your Lord. Think about the hereafter. Think about not being burned. You still have a chance. There was somebody who won in his lifetime who was once an atheist and who went back to Islam. I think you could do that too. And he starts reading passages from the Quran. I don't get a word in. And I just want to know, Dad, what have you got?
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you? And so that's the first chapter of Nomad, and I explain that in depth. And it's painful. It's like being on an emotional roller coaster. Everything that I've been trying not to feel for a while, I've been trying to be strong, all that comes out. That's the first. I start infidel or in nomad with that. And I follow up on that because my father passes away. I feel fortunate that I'm able to go to his deathbed in the UK. I relate to the story of how that, the details of how that takes place. But I'm just happy that I'm able to hold his hand as he's passing away. It's just compelling. It's a very, very private feeling.
Yes.
And then I'm filled with regret, and I think I've wasted time. Why did I not talk to him all these years? Why didn't we call one another? What was between us? And then I start to think, maybe I shouldn't have run away in July 1992. Maybe I should have stayed. Maybe I should have done what he did. And I'm in touch with two people in my family. One cousin who's helping me and who's telling me all about everything that's going on. And my younger half-sister, who I point to in Infidel, but I don't discuss in detail. And the more I get to talk to her, the more I think, if I had stayed in 1992, if I hadn't taken that train from Germany to Holland, if I had gone to Canada, my life would have looked like hers.
She's in London, is she not?
She's in London. She lives in the Tower Hamlets. And she's leading a life that I have come to understand as a problem that you probe into, called, why are Muslim immigrants not assimilating into European society? She's one of my subjects. And so I think, oh my goodness, I don't regret it. I'm glad that I paid the price that I paid. And it was painful, and I'm glad I lived. And I'm glad I'm not living, I'm not leading her life. I'm not in that permanent dissonance. But she seems happy.
Well, that's interesting. I was going to ask you about her and also about your brother in the context of, and I understand what you're saying, because when you are raised and the family means everything and the clan means everything, if you break away, you never really get rid of that guilt, no matter how much you try to justify what you've done and no matter how very justified what you've done seems to be. It's very hard, especially in times of parents dying, etc. But you say, this is very interesting what you say, but she seems very happy. And I find that a lot of Muslim women, especially many of them who wear the veil, for example, will come and say, but I'm happy. This is my choice. And of course, choice is important, but there is the factor of the collusion of women in the patriarchy. And I know this is a sensitive subject, but your own grandmother was the person who had you excised. So she was collusive entirely. Mm-hmm. So what do you make of this, and how do you think we can change this collusion that we Muslim women, have in the patriarchy, especially here in the United States now, that we have freedom?
Well, maybe I think we have to rethink and review what we mean by patriarchy, in the sense that, and this is what I've learned over and over again, watching women who, starting with my grandmother, who was not just someone who believed in female genital mutilation, but who actually practiced it and imposed it on us, that I'm growing up in the context of misogyny justified in the name of Islam, in the name of Islamic tribal culture. And I don't know if I can just dismiss that as patriarchy, as so many women not only participate in it, but impose other women on it. You may all be familiar with the concept of honor killings. And what I see, when I was a member of parliament in the Netherlands, when I was a translator, what we saw in these, if you studied every single case, it wasn't just the men. In fact, the men, the brothers and the cousins and the nephews, the husbands, the fathers, they got involved at a later stage. The first stage is one woman, a sister or a mother or mother-in-law reporting to another woman, another relative and saying, I saw her, she was wearing, she dropped her headscarf, she was wearing makeup, she was seeing so-and-so. So, you know, you, your honor is going to be all tramped on. Do something about it. So there's a great deal of participation from women. And I just think it is a whole framework of ideas. It is... It's a culture in, yes, where one gender has been taught to dominate. The other gender has learned how to survive within those circumstances. And those women who learn to manipulate the system, because that's a system of its own, those women are actually much harder to change and to convince, right, to accept change and progress, to empathize with the victims of that system, even though they themselves are victims. And that's very complex. And I don't know what the answer is to that.
Yeah.
But I think it starts with exchanging our stories. I wrote Infidel not because I wanted to talk about my life story. I had just done political science, and I wanted to, just like my, I was competing with my peers. I wanted to write papers full of footnotes and statistics. And no one was interested in that. Every journalist who approached me, every researcher who approached me, even my colleagues were just interested in one question, which was, but how did you do it? You're here for 10 years in the Netherlands. How did you accomplish that? That's all they wanted to know. How about your father? What's your relationship with your father? What's the relationship with your mother? What is? And they would talk about my mother, and I just shut up about my mother. I've just written a paper. It's got all the footnotes. Please. No, we want to know about your mom. And she's like, I don't know. She's in Kenya. Get lost. And then gradually I came to understand, okay, so people here are really fascinated by not just the fact that you can show that you're capable of reading academic work, understanding it, and footnoting it. They're interested in experience. And most people in the United States and Europe have not had those experiences. So if we're all grouped together as people who are born into Islam and Islamic society and into the West, and some of us assimilate into it faster than others, then the whole point was, okay, tell us how you did it. And that means Infidel was a very subjective book. And I said, but it's going to be a very subjective book. Yes, it was a subjective book. Nomad is a subjective book. And so I try to use now the stories of my families mainly to encourage social scientists to go and scrutinize for generations the intimate family dynamics of the Muslim family.
Well, I think it's the best way to educate people about Islam, or educate people about the countries that are Islamic. I think that's why your book has been so popular. And I agree, the exchanging of stories is really important. I also, in your book, first I wanted to talk about the issue of raising sons in Islam. And you do have a chapter in Nomad about your brother and the way he was raised. And there's more detail in there about how your father treated him and how harshly. And I've seen this in my own family. It's sort of the perpetuating of, you know, you have to be a prince, you have to be perfect, you have to be domineering, a hero.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you almost are, you fail before you begin.
Yeah.
And how can we change that in this country? I think.
And you know, you're the sister, you're the sibling, and you find your sibling, your brother, even though my brother and I fought a lot, but I just see him being treated badly by my father. And I feel pain. It hurts me. But I can't stand up to my father. I can't tell him, Dad, stop that. That's wrong. And even if I can say, stop it, it's wrong. I don't know why it's wrong. I exposed, and I do it because after Infidel was published, audiences like you said, oh my goodness gracious, God Almighty, women are treated so badly within Islam. And I was like, yeah. But how about boys, little boys? They're brought up with a split identity. On the one hand, there is their context, which is increasingly modern. Even if it's not in the US and Europe, I grew up in large cities, Mogadishu, Riyadh and Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, Nairobi in Kenya. These are cities. They are not as hip and modern as San Francisco and New York, But they're cities in their own rights. They are. It, you don't ride camels. You don't go in hordes and attack other tribes. But the moral language that my brother was getting was, you are a hero. You're going to fight lions. You're going to conquer tribes. I'm talking about a six-year-old boy, a seven-year-old boy, a 10-year-old boy. He wants to come home and he says, okay, here is my report form. He's done a math test. He's got 93% of those questions right. And my mom is only worried about the 3% that he didn't get right.
That's right.
And, you know, that kind of thing. And so the poor boy, and I wanted to share that, please read that chapter on my brother. And I wrote it as intimate, and he may not agree with me. He may be hurt by it. He may have had a completely different perspective of it. But I have seen the boy being treated that way. And after writing Infidel, I just want you to also know, it's not just us girls. It's also the boys. It's the men. We don't learn what it is to empathize with another individual because the male individual is taught not to be soft but to be hard. He's going to be a hero of some sort. He should die for something bigger than himself. His honor is between my legs.
Right.
You know, and that goes on and on. Discipline her. My brother would watch my father cuddle me, call me all kinds of wonderful names and say, she's my only son, she looks at me in the eye, etc. And he would be called a woman. Go, hide behind the skirts of your mom. What becomes of that boy? I tell that story for two reasons. One, because women who are denied education, like my mother, or who deny themselves education, it's not just that they're actively denied. Some of them choose not to go to school. Some of them pull their daughters out of school. Women who have no education have, in a modern world, no idea of what parenting is like. The young men, sometimes older men that they're married off to, have a history themselves of being abused by their own fathers. And by abuse, I mean not actively abuse, not in the sense that someone knows they're doing something wrong, but they're brought up by people, two individuals who also don't know how to parent. And that perpetuates itself. And that creates not just a few families, but it creates villages and towns and whole demographies of people who just say, we have to rely on tradition and we have to rely on the Prophet Muhammad and we have to rely on God and we have to, inshallah, inshallah, inshallah. My son is a criminal. My son is doing... You don't say these things to one another. Somebody else comes in and says, you are in trouble. Your son has just banned the school. Right. And my mom, after she's done throwing the furniture, she's exhausted and she says, well, Allah willed it.
Yes. Yes. It's the hopelessness.
The hopelessness, the powerlessness.
And the helplessness.
And I'm revealing this not to be mean, but just to say, you know, once we understand that dynamic, maybe women like you and me can persuade other women to say, first of all, don't take children unless you're really ready for them, because it's quite a headache.
Mm-hmm. It is. I can attest to that.
And if you take one or two, please don't embark on taking 5 or 10 of them. Because, you know, you have a whole boarding school or prison if most of them are boys. As, you know, most Muslim families, let's be honest, they want boys. Mm-hmm. They want boys because the mentality has stayed on, we are tribes fighting against other tribes. So the more sons we have, the better. But we are not tribes fighting against other tribes. We live in small places where you have neighbors upstairs, neighbors downstairs, neighbors on either
That's
side.
Right.
You don't want your family making a lot of noise because the police is going to be called. Mm-hmm. This is the situation in modern life.
Yes.
And you have to learn to adapt to that situation, parent toward that situation, teach your children to adapt to that. And I tell these stories in Nomad to answer the questions that audiences like you have asked, to say, I think this is why. And I want also to generate your compassion and your understanding, not your rejection of immigrants and Muslim immigrants coming here. Rejection of their behavior, yes. Rejection of their culture, yes. But not rejection of them as human beings. And I trust that those human beings, once they find out that old habits and old customs, old ways of solving problems just don't yield the same successful answers, that some of them might start to open up to new notions and new ways of doing things.
This brings me to what you have spoken a great deal about in Nomad, and that is the rise of Islamic radicalism in the West. And I think since we're here in America, we may as well talk about America. When I was a little girl, I told you earlier, and growing up, there was one mosque in the entire country, and that was the one in Washington, D.C. Now there are thousands.
1,150.
What do you account? How do you account for this? Is it because immigrants are coming here from Islamic countries and sequestering their families and going into themselves, or is it because America is not as welcoming as it should be, or is it because of the cultural relativism? Why do you think this is happening?
Perhaps there's something else going on. You all put up your hands when you were asked, have you read Infidel? Do you remember Sister Aziza, Muslim girls secondary school? I'm 15 years old, and I'm in Form 2, Form 3. We have a class called Islamic Religious Education, and our teacher does a number of things that in hindsight are very interesting. She's not Mrs. Yusuf. Mm-hmm. The title Mrs., she doesn't use it. She says, I'm Sister Aziza. And she comes in completely covered. She had a heart-shaped face, all pale, and everything else was in black. Very mysterious, and I have to say very beguiling in a way, because, wow. She looked very different from all of our other teachers. She talked to us differently. And she was one of us. She was Swahili, born in the coast of Kenya. And instead of teaching the history, which was the curriculum, the history of Islam, where you get to know Islam is 1,400 years old, and the conquests and the Abbasids and the Umayyads and blah, 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 she starts to say, do you pray? No, no, no. The first question she asks is, are you a Muslim? So for the Muslim students who chose that class, and that class was voluntary, you just think, yeah, of course I'm a Muslim. I mean, hey, I'm in the IRE, I'm in the Islamic religious class. I'm not in the Christian religious class. I'm a Muslim. And then she says, but how do I know you're a Muslim? And she's soft-spoken and she's sweet and so on. And so we go, and from there she carries on the logic. But why, how do I know you're a Muslim? You're not separating yourself from the infidels. You're not covering yourself. You're not praying five times a day, etc. That dynamic, that woman did not represent American foreign policy. At the time, America didn't even live for us. She wasn't representing Israeli foreign policy. She wasn't representing any foreign policy. Maybe you could say she was representing the Saudi foreign policy.
Yes.
We were drawn slowly into her way of thinking about right and wrong. We were no longer 15-year-olds going to school and learning about the history of our religion. We were now slowly being transformed into activists by a person we admired and trusted in a language that we understood, who was one of us. And that woman had spent years, and I don't know how she was recruited or enticed into this movement, but she had spent years in Medina completely brainwashing herself or being brainwashed. I don't know. Many of us got attracted to it. And I have to admit at that age, I did so too. I started to look like her, dress like her, believe things as she did. Now, was that an energy, was that a movement that was only present in Kenya, in Africa, in the Middle East? No. It was also here in the United States. It was here in Europe. So if you go from one mosque in your time to 1,150 for a population of maybe 8 to 10 million people, then you start to wonder, and it makes me wonder, and it did make me wonder, and I looked into it, who's building these mosques? What is the message that they're conveying? Who is in charge of these Muslim centers, etc.? So Islam, submission to the will of Allah, that brings together millions, if not billions of people, is used by a foreign power, and that is foreign policy, to targets specifically vulnerable communities. And I say vulnerable because these are people who have, you know, why Muslims come to America? They come, like all other immigrants, in search of a better life.
Economic.
It starts with an attempt to improve your economic life. And once you come here, it's probably natural that you start to seek out people who look like you, your cousins, if you're Iran, with the Iranians, if you're Somali, Somalians, if you're Pakistani, with the Pakistanis. And then you already have communities that exist that can be targeted. And there is one movement financed by Saudi Arabians, first the government, and after 2001, 2002, after the 9/11 commission, they were clamped on. Saudi Arabia was forced not to finance them. So now it's done. They say it's individuals. And what's taught is Wahhabism. What is taught is an extremist ideology. And we are all searching, soul searching, and saying, maybe it's American foreign policy. Maybe it's Israeli foreign policy. Maybe it's something else. What is it that motivates a young man like Faisal Shahzad, who was living the American dream, who found a visa to this country, who found, you know...
Well, I say if he still had a job, he wouldn't have done that. Well, so when economic times get more difficult, young people tend to be drawn more...
Well, I have a problem with that. I have a problem with that.
Okay.
I have a problem with that.
I don't know who that was for.
Let me say it fast. Let me say the problem that I have with it.
Okay.
If we accept, if we find it acceptable, if we even remotely entertain the idea that if you lose your job, that there's one way to express your misery, and that's by killing other people, we are really going down. I mean, ever since 45 million or 45,000 years ago, when humanity became, after Homo sapiens, humans have known misery. They've lost their livelihoods. They had to recreate it. Some didn't accomplish it. Some did. Some were heroic. Literature is all about that. Human history is all about that. If we start to acknowledge and entertain the idea that foreclosures and healthcare and all kinds of normal adversity is an excuse to take away the lives of others, to take away a guy with an MBA who gives up his job and decides, hey, the only way for therapy is to get an SUV and fill it with propane gas and
bottle other
people. No, I'm not doing that. But
of course, if you put it that way, it sounds ridiculous, but...
But I'm sorry, but that is the problem with that argument. And we've seen it. He has a freaking MBA.
Yeah.
He could have done something else. I know people who can't read or write and who have jobs. They work two jobs, three jobs, and they feed their kids. I have friends in New York who had to sell their houses and move to the country and had to scale down. I know lots and lots of people who scaled down.
Right.
But I don't know anybody who sat together, even when we drink lots and lots of drinks, who say, let's go kill other people. Let's blow
No, I agree with you. Yeah. And I
that's the problem with that argument. But that's why I'm saying let's not excuse them. Let's look at what he said and what he did and his activities. Major Nidal gets to be a major in a voluntary military. He volunteered and he goes and kills his fellow military men. And he doesn't say it's because he was called a racist. He calls for Allahu Akbar. Any of the written email exchanges that he has had with Anwar al-Awlaki was, I want to join you in the hereafter. He wasn't talking about how his colleagues were racist and so on. The guy who killed Theo van Gogh, for a long time, the entire Dutch nation was speculating about how Theo van Gogh might have offended him by calling Muslims goat fuckers. When that man got a chance to talk, he said, oh, no, I wasn't insulted at all by that. I was doing it for God. And I just think, why don't we take these people at their word? Why don't we just examine their convictions? Mm-hmm. And
I
This is a really hard interview.
I love San Francisco. I love the food. I love the people. You guys are so rational. Okay, no, I'm enjoying myself.
Well, I do agree with you that this we should never excuse what these people are doing. We shouldn't excuse, for example, what Timothy McVeigh did or any other terrorist has done in the name of their beliefs, whatever they may be. And I am totally with you on the idea of cultural relativism and the issues of multiculturalism. There are many facets in Islam that I just find abhorrent, and I don't think they should be excused in any way. Especially, well, I wanted to ask you about this issue of what is going on in Washington State regarding the female circumcision and this idea that, I don't know if everyone has heard about this, but there are American doctors who are championing the allowance of nicking the clitoris in order to sort of satisfy the idea of female circumcision. So that then, and their excuse is that if we do this for these families who want, then they won't perhaps then perform the act on the kitchen table in a more, horrifying way or extensive way. And then, of course, there's Canada, and then there's some areas, some other countries who are considering instituting Sharia law for family issues. I know you feel very strongly against this, but what is the answer? And I know solutions are very difficult to create, but what is your answer? If you can't convince your own father, and I can't convince my own cousin to be an atheist or to renounce the idea of Islam, how can we change that in this country besides just being angry and saying this person, you know, there's no excuse for what this person has done?
Well, it starts with saying there's no excuse and then understanding. So the nicking option, for instance, the American Academy of Pediatrics started out by looking at, who practices female genital mutilation, why do they do it, how many of them are mutilated, and I think some of the pediatrics have discovered that in the United States of America, in Europe, some families sneak their daughters out, take them to the countries of origin, and have them mutilated. They have their clitorises cut off, or parts of it, and have the opening of, excuse my explicit language, their vaginas sewed shut, and sometimes worse. So the pediatrics thought, hey, maybe if we offer them a milder, because there is a milder form of doing that, if we offer those parents some version of it, we do it with anesthesia, we do it in a hospital, it's clean, instead of with sharp rocks, razor blades, and scissors, where, you know, children die. They get forever injured. They get paralyzed. And so they were moved by compassion. And as these things come out, you know, people come to the United States, they bring with them their practices, they bring with them their convictions. And I've written about this, I think it's been published in the Daily Beast.
Yes.
And I say, look, there are four different ways of doing female genital mutilation. The nicking option, the option where you just tweak the clitoris and you put a needle through it, and when it bleeds, everybody's happy and they feel that the little girl is cleansed for whatever reason. It might be irrational, but hey, that's how they do it. That option, I'm not for it. And if the American Academy of Pediatrics think that that's going to work, then they have to at least consider why the three other options are done where more of the genitals are cut. And that's done because of the conviction by parents that the girl has to be a virgin on her wedding night. That's why the vagina is sewn shut, because then you have an empirical proof that she hasn't been with someone else. The clitoris is halved or quartered because they want to convince themselves she's not going to go crazy when she becomes a teenager, and she's not going to cheat on her husband when she's married off all this then comes back to honor. Now, if we understand that, if we were able to convince all the men who believe in this to give that up, the notion of virginity, that a woman owns her sexuality, that men can organize in their own societies and say, we don't want mutilated women. We don't care about their hymens. We want a fellow human being with whom we have a relationship, with whom we can relate to. We can raise children. We can be partners. If Arab Muslim men were to take that initiative, female genital mutilation in the Muslim world would come to a halt. But as long as the conviction exists, on the one hand, my daughter is never, ever going to be married unless I can prove she's a virgin, on the one hand, and men, on the other hand, I'm not going to marry a woman for whom I'm not 100% sure she's a virgin, then not only that practice, but all other kinds of abominable practices against women will continue. I prefer to go to the root of the matter. In talking about mutilation, I would like to mutilate the conviction that women have to remain virgins. That, and I think that is what coming to America, coming to the West, getting an education, observing, learning to discover what are the convictions behind it, how do we articulate it, that's what it has taught me. And I would like to activate feminists to get along with this, not just say, oh, poverty, 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 let's get rid of poverty, because poverty is an outcome of these convictions. Poverty is sometimes an outcome of principle. Actually, it's often an outcome of principle. And we're letting men off the hook. Why do you, for goodness sake, want a woman who's mutilated and completely shut up? Yeah. So that is where, and I think if people who are really serious about reforming Islam, especially the part that deals with women, that's what these men should be doing. That's what they should organize instead of just protesting against people like me or saying, oh, it's not Islam, it's something else. This is what I think they should organize to do.
Ayan, in Nomad, as you said earlier in our conversation, this is a very complex situation, trying to understand what's going through the minds of people who are fundamentalists and radicals and how to somehow curtail their activities and their influence. And I felt very strongly that towards the end of the book, you felt you had to offer some solutions because, of course, even as I am doing, everyone is asking you, what should we do? What should we do? How can we stop this? And one of your solutions was very, I'm sure you'll understand, was surprising to me. And that was your advocating that the Catholic and the Christian churches get together and convert all the Muslims, basically.
That's very naughty of me.
Yes. It's very naughty. And I actually did think to myself, why is she doing this? And why is this suddenly here? And I thought to myself, oh, this is her rebellious streak. She needs to be a little more rebellious or outlandish. But it was disturbing to me, frankly. Because when I was growing up in this country, as I said, there was only one mosque, but there was also, in my world growing up, there weren't any evangelical Christians. There was very little Christian fundamentalism and not very many Orthodox Jews. And I grew up in New York, and my grandfather was a Jew, so I know about that. My grandmother was a Christian. So fundamentalism for me now is everywhere. It's not just, I mean, my son grew up in a school where if you were going to be cool, you had to belong to the evangelical church. And this frightened me. And it still frightens me since I saw what happened in Iran and witnessed it. What are you thinking?
What were you thinking? Why do you want Muslims to become Christians? For goodness sake. I think, well, the superficial answer is, you know, if every Muslim were to become a Christian, then I would have to live without bodyguards.
That's a good reason.
I understand.
I got, after Infidel was published, I got a number of letters, and I'm going to ask for permission to have those emails and letters published by fellow Muslims, people with a background like mine, saying, I relate to this, I relate to that. And some of them have become atheists, and are really very comfortable with it, with the Enlightenment. Emails about John Stuart Mill, emails about Karl Popper, emails about Thomas Hobbes, you know. People come here and they think, oh my goodness, the Founding Fathers, great, I'm a Jeffersonian. And I think, oh, wonderful, wonderful. So I'm not alone. So the first sensation I have is, oh my goodness, I'm not the only Muslim who feels this, yes. And some of them are men from Afghanistan, many from Iran. I have lots and lots of Iranian friends who just after having said, yeah, infidel, saying this, not just Islam, but all religion is evil. And then I got more emails, also from women, saying, I don't want to be a Muslim anymore. I don't want Allah. I don't want Muhammad. But I can't never, ever be an atheist. There's just something in me that says there is a higher force out there that we don't understand. La, 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 la.
So be an agnostic.
Or a Buddhist, or a Hindu, or whatever.
Yeah.
But so many of them have become Christian. Now,
interesting.
I'm reading those emails. I'm also in Rome, and I'm with a Catholic priest.
Wait till you read this chapter.
And I've been making fun of the Catholic Church, and I've been making fun of Christians, and when I was in Parliament, I voted for taking money away from, and I think that was philosophically a mistake. In any case, I voted for it, that they would not, it was a party that excluded women from their party, and they were getting money from the government. And I thought, we're not going to give you money until you include women. And, you know, if you think more deeply about it, if the government is supposed to be neutral and impartial to all political parties, then it's not supposed to intrude into their manifestos.
Right.
So in that case, I was a little hasty. But that aside, I'm with this Christian priest, Catholic priest in Rome, and we go out to dinner, and his concept, and I keep asking him about, yeah, but what about this? What about women? What about gays? What about science? What about teaching creationism? You know, why are you teaching creationism? Creationism is nonsense. Why do you want to replace the biology class with nonsense, with the Bible? Why don't you just have a Bible class? There's so many temples of Christianity, la, 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 la. And he is absolutely, you know, fantastic on all of this. And he says, you know, he's very honest. He says, not for all Christian leaders, but for leaders like him, Catholicism is not about the secular mundane things. It's some kind of higher level, mm-hmm. some force up there. Very much like the letters that I was getting from fellow Muslims who wanted to give up Islam but wanted still to believe in a higher force. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's the greatest matchmaking I can ever do. What if all Muslims became like him and they would have him for a leader, and then I would have to shed my bodyguards and there would be no threats, etc. Now, this may sound funny, and I think the concept of, because people have different, if you are an atheist and you believe that the concept of God is created by man, then, and man has created many different things. So you see, you find a concept of a God. Some of my Jewish friends tell me about their concept of God, and he's a God with whom you fight and you throw mezzo balls at him. And you never agree with him, and you say, yeah, but if you really love us, what did you do this? And you have a continuous, I don't know if Jewish people will share that, but they also told me we never ever proselytized. Actually, it's very hard to become Jewish, even if you want to be
very
Jewish.
Hard.
Yeah, you have to go through a whole process. A big mistake when it comes to competition in demographics. Christians have, and I'm not talking about Christianity even 50 years ago, but Christianity now in the modern cities, in Europe here, moderate Christians who just have reduced their concept of God to someone who's loving and cherishing and is in no way in disagreement with whatever they do on a daily basis, and definitely not hostile to science and the Enlightenment. And I think, wow, that's a great creation. I mean, hey, cuddly, loving. Mm-hmm. And they've abolished hell, which means if you, there's an exit option.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I'm not kidding.
Can you introduce me to those Christians?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Lots of them. And yeah, I always ask, true. I ask every believer, how about hell?
But the Catholic Church has not abolished
hell. The official Catholic Church has not.
No.
But lots of people who call themselves Christians, whom I meet when I ask them about hell and heaven, they say, oh, there's no hell. We're all going to heaven, which I think, okay, great. So there's no punishment. And then there's the concept of God in Islam, which is fashionable. And many, many Muslims throw at me. They say, why is it the fastest growing religion? The fact that people say that is not just a defensive argument. It's true. It's one of the fastest. It's actually the fastest growing religion right now.
Well, it's one of the only growing religions right now.
Especially in the West. Mm-hmm. And that means that the concept of a God, of a created figure, a concept, you know, some imagined figure, who demands submission, complete submission of will, complete submission of responsibility. Mm-hmm. Kill the infidels. So I'll go and kill them. Beat your wife. My God tells me to do that. You submit your own individual responsibility. That is appalling. That is frightening. And if you look at the demography of people who are taking that on, and my job is to start experimenting with ideas. How do we combat that? And I like to seek answers, especially when it comes to ideas outside of military means and what the police could do. Because I think what the police could do, what Napolitano can do, she's doing, believe me. What I would like to do is then to say, okay, if there was just one mosque a few years ago and now there are 1,150, then it means that there isn't that much competition going on. And by competition, I mean presenting Muslim communities in the United States and in Europe with alternative ideas, preferably atheists, preferably pro-enlightenment, but even a different concept of a God. That the Jewish people don't want to proselytize. Hey, but the Christians used to do it, and the Christian concept of God has changed. So it doesn't sound that bad anymore. It's like if you have, yeah, if you have a bazaar of ideas, just go put your wares down, and you know, who knows? Maybe someone who's seeking the difference between good and wrong, somebody who's looking for, yeah, some kind of comfort, spiritual comfort, or some kind of a community feeling, you could convince him. Humanists can do it. Atheists can do it. I would like feminists, love nothing more than feminists, to get their acts together and start telling Muslim women what it is like to be free, how cool that is. And, yeah, Christians, let's go compete with the jihadists. I believe we can win. It's not that strange.
No, it's okay. We disagree.
No, but you know, humanity, think about all the strategic alliances that people who have different opinions have formed. Think of the time when Winston Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin formed an alliance to defeat Hitler. They didn't agree on anything. But that strategic alliance at that time was necessary. And I think that the differences between Christians and atheists and feminists today is less profound than the three of us against radical jihadists. Sorry.
Okay, I've been told I need to get some audience questions. I have been integrating them in here, so I don't want anyone to feel like I'm ignoring them. But here's one. Can you tell us about other Muslim women who successfully integrated into secular European society? How did they do it?
I know a number, and unfortunately, all of them, for some reason, are threatened, live in hiding, or have aliases. Note that. Many of them were women who were able, and it's really important, who were able at a critical point in their lives to extricate themselves from the social control of their families. In 1993, I consciously decided I don't want to be in the Somali community. Not because I hated Somalis and I was participating in self-hatred, but because just the constant put on your headscarf. Why are you not doing it? Share your stuff. You know, just being told what to do, what not to do. Not being able to attend class because I was attending more to the social needs of the community. I was more worried about what they would think about me as opposed to what I really wanted. And I had paid the price of making my father angry by leaving the man that he forced me to marry. So I wasn't going to sit around people who were chewing cards, serving them tea until 3 a.m. So in 1993, I decided I'm not going to do this. And the other women, I know two women in Germany, three women in Holland. I mean, there are more, but these are women who are in the prominent in their own countries, a few in Denmark, in Norway. We all shared, yeah, I stopped going to Somali parties, Pakistani parties, these ethnic parties, Turkish parties, Moroccan parties. I stopped feeling, I immunized myself to their criticism. I decided to get absorbed into my new world and to absorb what they had to offer. And then as a strong woman, on my own terms, I went back and started to reestablish relationships with them. That's what happened. And by then, you know, by the time Bin Laden had, you know, blown up the Twin Towers, I was able to articulate what I felt and what I thought, not what the community told me to feel and what to think. And I think that's really, and that's why I'm against ghettos. Because the more ghettoized a society, these communities get, the more they just get swallowed up in the old world that they left behind.
Right.
Yeah.
What aspects, and I'll add a little bit of my question here too, what aspects of Islamic culture, if any, do you still appreciate? Can you share some of your thoughts on this? And I would like to add that there are some Islamic countries, mm-hmm. like Iran, for example, where I've been calling myself an atheist for many years and nobody cares. I wish they would care more, I'd get more press, so that I could give my thoughts about what's going on in Iran and hope that that regime would change. But there are countries and cultures where women are, Lebanese cultures, where women are forcefully being independent mm-hmm. and are taking things from the culture. So what are your thoughts about this? And some people criticize you because you say Muslims in general, but I know you're not saying that.
No, I never say Muslims in general. I say Islam.
Yeah.
And I think it's important in trying to think about it. I'm paid to think, or at least to pretend, I think. But when you think about these things, then you have a language, and in that language you draw constructs and concepts. And so what I try to do is separate Muslims from Islam, which you obviously can do in theory, even though in practice that's a little more difficult. But in theory, a Muslim is an individual, a man, a woman, of whatever ethnicity, speaks a different language. There's a lot of diversity among Muslims. There are 1.5 to 1.7 billion Muslims, 1.5 to 1.7 different minds. When you take Islamic theology, the Quran, the Hadith as left behind, that's the theology. Now, if the question you just asked me is there anything you appreciate in the Quran and the Hadith, I'll say, just like Bernard Lewis, who's looked into it, the initial part, the revelations in Mecca, that were all preaching peace and tolerance and unity and taking care of orphans, all of that is great. What comes after that, when Muhammad goes to Medina, has a large enough army, and then goes on from being spiritual to being a conqueror? That's what I reject. And when people ask me, do you think that Islam can be reformed?
I was just going to ask you that.
Exactly. Reformation. First of all, if you use the word reform, you're assuming there is something wrong. Something has to be corrected. Something has to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And what needs to be fixed, in my view, is to have all the revelation that comes after Medina to be deleted.
Mm-hmm. So, and the hadith as well.
And the hadith. The hadith, in fact, most of the hadith, because the hadith is... the hadith also goes... The problem with the hadith is it also goes into detail. Mm-hmm. It starts to spell out how much of the female skin should be covered. Now, that's not a religion. That's totalitarianism.
And Muhammad... We don't know if Muhammad even said any of those things.
In fact, we don't even know if Muhammad existed.
Yeah. You know, this is true.
We don't know.
He was... Yeah.
We don't know because there are researchers who are saying he may or he may not have existed. There is a hypothesis that he may not have existed.
Oh, really?
And it's clamped down on with threats and so on. And so then you never get to the truth. There are people who hypothesize that Jesus may not have existed. Mm-hmm. But that's no problem. So if you really believe that he existed, then it becomes academic. It really doesn't become a life-threatening matter. To me, the question, did Muhammad exist or did he not exist, is academic. What is not academic are individual human beings living right now saying, I'm going to marry a 9-year-old or a 14-year-old. I'm going to participate in killing other people because Muhammad told me to. And then Muhammad exists. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It doesn't matter, even if he never exists, but those ideas exist. And then it's worth exploring those ideas. And if you say, is there anything right about Islam? I would say those Meccan chapters. When the founder of the religion, whether he existed or not, the founder of the religion, let's assume he did exist, was preaching just goodness and unity, take care of the orphans, be hospitable, be generous, universal mm-hmm. goodness. And then after that, when he goes to Medina, that part has to be debated. He creates a civilization or he inspires a civilization. He inspires conquest. He inspires men to unite and fight for the sake of Allah. All of that has to be re-examined and I think shared. And so the average American Muslim who says, I want to adhere to the American Constitution, I want to be a patriotic American, and yet I want to call myself a Muslim, I would say, well, that means that you have to relinquish 3/4 of the Quran.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm going to ask you one last question. In Nomad, you have a chapter that is a letter to your unborn child. A la Oriana Fallaci, who I adore, or did adore as well. And in there you talk about how you want her to live and to think and to grow up. And it's fascinating and very sweet. What I want to ask you is, what would you do if your daughter or your son came to you as a teenager and said they wanted to be...
They wanted to be a Muslim.
And I'm not saying this to trap you yeah. by any means, but to ask you to give your opinion to women and men who are dealing with this very thing
yeah.
in this country, where they have teenagers, and usually it is teenagers, who put on the veil for reasons of belonging or rebellion, or who go to Waziristan for vacation. Yeah. What would you say, do you think?
Well, I would be devastated. I mean, if I were a parent and my son or my daughter says, I'm a heroin addict or I'm...
Muslim.
No. It's not. It's just that what you want for your child is the best that you can give them. And I write that letter as an answer to a question and actually often an attack from people I've come to call cultural and moral relativists and very complacent who say, oh, don't worry, you're just being too fastidious. It's going to take Muslims 600 years to adapt to modernity because it took Christians that long. Christianity is about 600 years older than Islam, so it's going to take that long. And then I narrate the story, as you've read in Infidel, about my grandmother and then her daughter. My grandmother moved from waterhole to waterhole and led a fully nomadic life with camels and the whole thing, and had never seen the modernity until much, much later in her life. My mother is partly, in her head, in her mind, that split personality. She is immersed in the values of the nomadic tribal life, becomes a very, very devout Muslim, but goes from city to city and rejects modern values. As her daughter, the third female in that line, I fully come to accept modern values, but I'm rejected by my family. And imagining a child of mine, that child would, as mine, hopefully be immersed, will not have that, I hope, that identity crisis. So this is not to say, that letter is just to show it can take four generations. And actually, some people, it takes them even less, depending on how much, whether parents reject you or not. I know there's a Miss USA who's completely supported by her parents in what she does. I mean, that's even a much shorter...
My father, my family, same.
Same
my
thing.
Father was raised in Orthodox, and he is no longer an adherent.
Yeah, and so then that can happen. You can't just close that door and say it's going to take 600 years. Now, what am I going to do if my child decides to become a jihadist? I would be devastated. I would hate that. But then as Oriana tries to show me when I say, oh, yeah, but I'm scared of... She said, you can't be scared. You can't be scared of the unknown. You can all imagine numerous things that could happen to your children and could convince yourselves not to have a child. In fact, many Europeans do that, and that's why the demography there is shrinking. And some of the reasons... Seriously, some of the arguments you hear is, yeah, but then... By then, if I have a child now, then I won't be able to have that pension, and I won't be able to have daycare, so I better not have it at all.
Yeah.
So this is, you don't know, you don't control it.
That's right. You're never going to be ready if you think about it.
You'll never be ready. You can just give them, you can do your best, and then they're free. And that's what I wanted my parents to do for me. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way, that's probably what I want to correct.
Well, I think you'd make a wonderful mother.
So
I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be in San Francisco.
Under normal circumstances, I would say I hope you enjoyed this evening's program. But I know that you have been moved and enlightened by this evening's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Ayan Hirsay Ali, the extraordinary woman and author of Nomad, From Islam to America, A Personal Journey Through the Clash of Civilizations. And, of course, to Suzanne Pari, our moderator, author of The Fortune Catcher, our audience in Palo Alto, and to those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is regrettably adjourned.